Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Well, hey everyone, welcome back to Profiling Evil. Today, we're diving into a gripping legal saga that captivated this nation. It's the Tex MacGyver trial. So buckle up as we explore the twists, the turns, and the jaw-dropping moments of this courtroom drama. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Profiling Evil's Down the Rabbit Hole. We're discussing the murder of Diane MacGyver in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, she was shot and killed in a seedy part of the community just moments after her husband, Tex, saddled up with his firearm, something that he grabbed because he was nervous about the area of town that they were driving around in. Now listen, I hope you're going to take a moment and hit that like and subscribe button and ring the bell so that you're getting all of Profiling Evil's videos. And please share Profiling Evil with your friends and contacts. And thanks so much for supporting us. Now before we get into this nitty-gritty story, let's set the stage. Tex MacGyver is really known as Claude Lee MacGyver. Now, his nickname is Tex MacGyver. MacGyver was a partner at a large Atlanta, Georgia law firm who prosecutors allege was also a guy who was at the tail end of his career. He was spending way more money than he made, and he looked to his wife's insurance as a way to maintain his lifestyle. Now, the MacGyvers were wealthy and well-connected. Diane MacGyver, the victim in this case, was the president of U.S. Enterprises, Inc. It's part of the parent company of Corey Airport Services. Now, MacGyver's defense team suggests that Tex was a man who was afraid of being in this seedy side of Atlanta. And while holding a handgun, he accidentally fired it into his wife, killing her. Now get ready for a roller coaster of events, events that are going to leave you questioning everything you've learned about this case so far. And here's where things get real. We're going to break down the incident that sparked the trial, and we're going to shed some light on the details that played a crucial role in the courtroom. You're not going to believe the complexity of this case, so frankly, buckle up. Now, let's go back to the night of September 25th, 2016. Now, Danny Jo Carter was a close friend of Diane MacGyver, and she was driving the couple's Ford Expedition as the three returned from a weekend at their 80-acre horse farm that's about 75 miles east of Atlanta, Georgia. I mean, this place, this ranch, was massive, and it was incredibly nice. In fact, Nancy Grace reported on her podcast that the MacGyvers were spending more than $20,000 per month just to keep the place going at the ranch. So just keeping the lights turned on. Now, Diane MacGyver was sitting in the front seat of the vehicle, and this woman, Carter, was driving. Tex MacGyver was in the back seat directly behind his wife. Now, traffic was heavy on the interstate, so Carter took an exit into downtown Atlanta. This immediately concerned Tex, who said, "Girls," quote, by the way, "girls, I wish you hadn't done this. This is a really bad area," close quote. Well, he either took advantage of a perfect opportunity or things just happened. But MacGyver asked his wife to get his .38 caliber revolver out of the center console of their SUV and hand it to him. Now, MacGyver would later tell the state investigators that he relaxed after a bit and he fell asleep, actually cradling the weapon in his lap. He awoke to the sound of the gun going off. The bullet, it passed through the front seat where his wife was sitting and into her body, mortally wounding her. Now, I wanted to pause just for a minute and paint a picture in your mind, because according to MacGyver, he was kind of cradling the pistol in his lap. Now, here's the pistol. He's right-handed, and common sense would suggest that if he was in fact doing this, he most likely would be pointing that weapon to his left if he's right-handed and holding it in his right hand. Now, this is really important, because if this guy was asleep and the weapon accidentally discharged by him pulling the trigger, by the way, it seems to me that the bullet would exit out the rear passenger door since he's sitting in the back. But it didn't do that. It went straight forward into Diane's back. Now, I'd like you to take a moment and try to visualize and act this out and think about what might have happened in your own mind. Now, certainly possible that it could have been pointed forward, but then he would be holding it like this in his lap, and if he's sleeping, it might be down. Why is that thing up and in the ready position? My question is, possible, but is it probable? And this is one of those moments where behavior becomes incredibly important. Now, it becomes important because if MacGyver was so terrified about this area of town that they were in that he asks for the weapon, would this guy really, minutes later, fall asleep? I mean, it was just a mere couple of minutes from the time in which he suggested that he was so terrified he asked for the weapon. Now, upon being shot, Diane MacGyver utters, quote, "Tex, what did you do?" close quote. To which Tex responded that the gun simply discharged. Well, this brings up another interesting situation. Tex MacGyver directs Carter to then drive to Emory University Hospital. And by doing that, he passes up a much closer trauma hospital. Was this on purpose or just tunnel vision of get me to a hospital? Now, reports suggest that Diane MacGyver dies in the operating room from her injuries, which were to her spine, her pancreas, her kidney, and her stomach. Now, there was never any dispute in this case that MacGyver shot his wife. The question at the first trial, the one he was convicted in, was all about whether he meant to shoot her. Now, prosecutors successfully convinced the jury in the first trial that he intended to kill Diane, and they say it was because he was after her money. On the flip side, defense attorneys are saying that's absolute nonsense and that the shooting was a terrible accident after Tex had fallen asleep with the gun in his hand. Again, kind of act that out in your mind. Well, in the end, the jury found MacGyver guilty of murder, and that first case was back in 2018. The guy went to prison for life. Now, he was also convicted of witness tampering, and he was sentenced to life in prison. Everything seemed finalized until 2022, when the Supreme Court reversed MacGyver's conviction, saying that the trial court erred in denying his request to charge the jury on the lesser involuntary manslaughter offense. In other words, the judge was supposed to tell the jury, you can find him guilty of this murder charge, or you can find him guilty of a lesser charge if you don't think that it was intentional. Didn't do it, and that's what sent this whole thing back. Well, then, Presiding Justice Michael Boggs, who's now the court's Chief Justice, wrote in a unanimous opinion the following. He said, quote, "While the state's evidence was sufficient to support the appellate's conviction of murder, it also could have supported the finding that the appellant killed the victim without any intent of doing so in the commission of an unlawful act," close quote. And that's where this thing really gets sticky and the thing that's probably going to keep this guy out of prison for life. And with that, MacGyver returned to court. And the hearing that we're talking about today all started coming about. And this thing was fast moving. So fasten your seatbelts, folks, because this guy is now getting a new trial. And the judge doesn't seem to be allowing the prosecution the chance to provide any evidence that would suggest that this was a murder attempt. Now remember, back in 2018, McIver was convicted of felony murder, first thing. Aggravated assault, the second thing. Possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony and influencing a witness. Now, he received a life sentence before the Supreme Court sent this thing back and put us where we are today. Let's take a minute and watch some local news where they kind of outline what's really at stake in this trial.
For a former attorney accused of shooting and killing his wife is on hold tonight. The move to stop Tex McIver's murder case came just a day after jury selection got underway. Channel 2 investigative reporter Mark Winnie, live for us now in Buckhead with the reason the judge made that decision. Mark?
Yeah, we're at the defense lawyer's offices where we spoke to one of those attorneys, but late this afternoon we got a copy of an order that from Judge Robert McBurney that is really going to have a major impact on what happens now in one of Georgia's most watched cases. It shows right there that it was filed in the clerk's office at 4:31 p.m. As a member of Tex McIver's defense team, what are you doing this afternoon?
We're preparing a bond motion to have him released pending the trial, which now is postponed for possibly as long as 6-7 months.
Will you oppose any efforts by the defense to get Tex McIver out on bond pending the state's appeal?
We will review any motion that we receive. However, the state has consistently opposed bond in this case, and I don't have any indication at this point that the office will change its position.
Has Judge McBurney given you an indication how quickly he will consider bond?
He said he would do it rapidly.
Don Samuel, one of Tex McIver's lawyers, says Judge Robert McBurney let lawyers on both sides of McIver's case know of his intent to issue a written order. Barring the prosecution from introducing evidence, McIver had an intent to kill his wife, Diane McIver, when he shot her in 2016, an incident that led to Tex McIver's conviction on felony murder and aggravated assault charges, which the Georgia Supreme Court overturned last year.
It follows logically from a ruling that the state cannot argue intent to kill, that the state would be prevented from entering evidence about life insurance because it's no longer relevant.
Samuel says because the prosecution signaled it will appeal, jury selection, which started Monday in what would have been McIver's retrial, stopped. Fulton County Executive District Attorney Mike Carlson.
Well, Georgia law allows for the state, the prosecution, to be able to appeal where a trial judge has excluded important evidence pre-trial. That occurred in this case, so the state is preparing its direct appeal on the issues that were presented today. This is certainly not an unusual occurrence for our office. In fact, we have had any number of high-profile cases where we've taken evidentiary issues up on appeal pre-trial.
Samuel says in his original trial, McIver was acquitted of malice murder, which involves intent to kill, but convicted of a felony murder charge that, the way it was written in McIver's case, did not involve the intent to kill. So the defense maintains it would be unconstitutional for the prosecution to argue something a jury has already unanimously rejected.
They couldn't change the indictment now.
It is our position they cannot change the indictment because all charges have to be brought in the initial indictment. That's another issue we're working on.
Do you anticipate they may try to reindict?
I do.
Carlson says the Fulton County DA's office maintains motive evidence, such as financial incentives, is important and widely admissible in violent crime prosecutions. A prosecution motion suggests case law makes clear motive evidence illustrating murderous intent is admissible to prove the charges of aggravated assault and felony murder.
It was absolutely an accidental shooting. He didn't intend to shoot his wife. He didn't intend to kill his wife. He didn't intend to pull the trigger.
He had fallen asleep with a gun in his lap.
That is correct. That might be negligent. That might be reckless. But the shooting was still accidental.
Now, Mike Carlson says the DA office position is the shooting was not accidental, and the office is appealing today's order so that it can present evidence to that effect in the retrial. Now, I asked Don Samuel if the prosecution follows through with an appeal to the Georgia Supreme Court, how long does he think, anticipate that taking? He said, I would guess 6 to 8 months. Reporting live, Mark Winnie, Channel 2 Action News.
Well, afterward, the Fulton County District Attorney's Office filed a new motion that took us to where we are today, saying that it was planning to retry McIver. They stated, quote, We're ready. Justice must prevail. We think he'll be found guilty again this time, and nothing's changed. Close quote. Well, I think a whole bunch has changed, and we're going to talk about that as we continue this video. In fact, the defense was equally confident, stating, quote, they can argue motive all they want as why he would want to shoot her. But what they can't do, in part based on what the Supreme Court held, and in part based on collateral estoppel, is prove that Tex MacGyver intended to kill his wife. Well, and that's where things are. And that's how things got incredibly sticky. Because a judge ruled that the state can't introduce evidence that suggests that MacGyver intended on murdering his wife. This means that a plea deal is certainly possible in this case. We already know they're not going to go after him for murder this time and just stick with aggravated assault. Now, this is all especially because of the evidentiary rulings that the Georgia Supreme Court has pushed down. And this could change the face of the evidence that could come in this case. So here's what really frustrates me. And that is that there is a whole bunch of evidence that probably will never come out in this trial, if it happens at all. One huge piece of history comes from information uncovered in the Intent, the Tex MacGyver case podcast, where Claude Lee MacGyver and his previous acts seem to eerily be revelatory of what would later happen to Diane. Now, in the Profiling Evil Academy, I've provided videos in the past on past behavior being predictive of future behavior. I hope you'll go back and listen to those videos. But for now, let's just play a short piece from the Intent podcast where MacGyver's past includes shooting in another incident. In fact, shooting at three people.
It's late at night on February 27th, 1990, when gunshots ring out on a quiet residential street in northeast Atlanta. Moments earlier, Claude MacGyver III had spotted a Ford Mustang in his cul-de-sac as he arrived home to let his dogs out. Tex, as he's known to most people, would step outside with a gun in hand. Three young men were sitting in the Mustang. Two would tell police they saw Tex pull out the gun and fire. First, two shots in the air, and then two shots in their direction.
And shortly after Diane MacGyver died, Tex MacGyver's behavior started to trouble a whole bunch of people, starting in the hospital, where his wife lay on an operating table. Just hours after his wife was pronounced dead, Tex appeared completely calm by some reports. Now, one person said that he never seemed to break down at all. In fact, a friend of decades said that Tex seemed to be more clear-headed than anyone who had just lost their wife, and more than anyone who lost their wife ought to be. Well, over the days that followed, the woman who was driving their SUV on that night when Tex shot Diane said that Tex had a whole bunch of visitors. Some were his friends, some were hers. But all of them noticed the same unusual things about Tex's behavior. He didn't seem emotional at the very minimum, and not in a way that people might have expected. Another person reported that less than 2 days after Diane died, her work colleagues came to pay their respects. They said Tex didn't appear to be grieving, but some felt like he seemed like he was more opportunistic and a gold digger than a grieving husband. He even went as far as remarking to a friend named Jay Grover, quote, I wonder if I can collect her checks now, close quote. Now, that same night, Grover also overheard Tex telling another sympathizer about a job opportunity he was looking into in Oklahoma. Now, the question on everybody's mind was, Tex already looking to move out of the state and his wife hadn't even been buried? Now, one of Tex's work colleagues recalled that Tex also asked him how he could begin collecting his wife's Social Security benefits. And at the same time he was asking about that, he was complaining that his salary at the law firm had been reduced. The rising cost of maintaining his ranch seemed to be outweighing his concern over losing his wife. This guy was acting in a way that a whole bunch of people were really confused about. Now, the thing that seemed to bother Tex's friend the most, though, was that he never said that her death was a terrible accident. He never said that he was sorry for what happened, that he shot her. And in all, Diane and Tex's associates all seemed to be really concerned that Tex wasn't acting like someone they would expect to act who had just lost their spouse to such a violent act. And while we want to acknowledge that we can't define how somebody should act or not act in a similar kind of a circumstance, I want you to take a minute and consider how you might act if you just lost someone who was your spouse, married to for over a decade, and more importantly, somebody that you just shot and killed, even if it was accidentally. Now, some people would be inconsolable. Others might be unable to eat or sleep. Others might cry for days on end, while some would choose to suffer in silence or deflect their grief in some way. We just don't know how Tex would have responded, but those who are close to him would know how he's responded to other instances when he was sad. Now, we got to consider that Tex's way of handling his grief was maybe to focus on his financial concerns. It might be that it was his way of escaping the inevitable, but the barrage of visitors, the funeral, the wakes, all of that would have been focusing him back on what was really going on, and it just doesn't appear that it was. These optics surrounding Tex's behavior may be the biggest challenge that this guy will face in a retrial. But some things seem awfully callous and calculating. Things like Tex's behavior on the day after his wife died. He called up his neighbor, and who happened to be also his former girlfriend. Her name was Janie, and he asked her to come over to his home and catalog Diane's closet so that he could determine how much her clothes, her shoes, her hats, her purses, and her furs were worth. And then, to add concern to this growing fire, Tex would actually sell all of his wife's belongings within 8 weeks. That is something that really kind of is troubling to me. But it was his behavior at her memorial service that negatively impacted people the most. Now, according to media reports, 2 days before her funeral, Tex spoke to his dead wife's assistant about the possibility of him getting married to a woman that he used to date and try to get her to leave that marriage and come back to him. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Grief certainly causes some interesting behaviors in this guy, but trying to get a new marriage before his wife's even buried is really bizarre. Kind of reminds you of the Daybells, doesn't it? But what do you think about all this, folks? I hope you'll be putting your answers down below. Well, you know, I joined Joseph Tully. He's a criminal defense attorney on Court TV to talk about this hearing with Julia Janae. Julia asked me how I might categorize the facts of this case and the limitations that have been placed on the prosecution, and I responded in this way.
But just to react to this news out of the courtroom, let's bring in criminal defense attorney Joseph Tully and retired police commander and host of the Profiling Evil podcast, Mike King. It's so good to see you both, Mike. And Mike King, you are the host of the Profiling Evil podcast, and this is one of those cases that has been attracting podcasters. They've been fascinated by the facts of this millionaire lawyer, his wife, who he seemed like he had a happy relationship with, but the prosecution says no. This was him trying to kill her inside of that car, but they won't be able to do that now. Your thoughts on just the impact of this case and the people watching it?
Well, I agree with the counselor that this is a win for the defense. It's really troubling to me, though, because when you're talking about a murder case and the ability or the inability to talk about behavior and the precipitating factors that were going on, if the prosecution's no longer able to talk about the fact that there was a ploy for getting money, that he was going to somehow be pushed out of whatever may come his way if his wife died through a natural cause, and now the ability to say he intended to shoot her when he took that gun, you can lay all the groundwork you would like that they pulled off on the wrong exit and that he asked for the gun out of fear. But if you're not able to talk about that after you've talked about things that lead up to motivation, the money grab, then it becomes really a difficult case for the prosecution. This is going to be an interesting one to watch unfold.
Definitely an interesting case, especially now with this. If you're just joining us, again, that breaking news out of Georgia is that the trial is going to be delayed against millionaire former lawyer Tex MacGyver.
Well, what are your thoughts, folks? I mean, do you agree with the hand the prosecution has been handed in this case? Do you think they're going to fail because of that? Now, as you're thinking about that, let's talk about some of the issues that the court's going to have to deal with in this case. And as I dig into these, remember, I'm coming at this as a retired criminal investigator, not an attorney. So we're going to have to wait and kind of rely and continue to watch the legal meanderings unfold in this case together to learn how this thing's going to be pieced together. But I think you're going to hear some things that are kind of troubling. In my opinion, here are the real challenges that are adding up to the complexity of this crime. The first challenge deals with whether this was an intentional act of attempted murder or an accident. Now, Tex MacGyver claims that the shooting was accidental, emphasizing that the gun discharged unintentionally while he was handling it in the back seat of the car. Remember, he said, he's sleeping, but the gun happened to be pointed directly at his wife. That's interesting. Not pointed out the window. Now, the legal challenge is to establish whether the shooting was a tragic accident or it was a deliberate act. I wonder what your thoughts are on that one. And undoubtedly, MacGyver's influence on witnesses is going to come into play on this. Remember, he was convicted of this. Witness intimidation wasn't thrown out when the rest of this case was. He's convicted of this. MacGyver faced charges related to influencing witnesses, and he was found guilty of it. The prosecution argued that he attempted to manipulate or alter the testimony of individuals who were involved in the case. Now, proving such influence and demonstrating the impact on the trial added then a real interesting layer of complexity to the case that might return in this particular rehearing. Now, I'm not sure whether the prosecution will get financial things into this trial, the motivation financially. Remember, the prosecution alleges that Tex MacGyver had a financial motive for this murder, claiming that he stood to benefit from his wife's death. Now, establishing a clear connection between the financial aspects and the alleged crime required through these investigations is going to be a real effective presentation of evidence. And that's going to be something that's going to be really tricky, especially with the judge saying you're not going to get certain pieces of this in. Now, both the defense and the prosecution are going to have to navigate the challenges of the presenting of evidence related to MacGyver's character and to his reputation. This is going to include assessing how this guy would be perceived by the jury, how the defendant and the victim are perceived by the jury. And these things can really impact significantly their final decisions. But like all cases, we have to think about the five forms of evidence. And I think this is going to play big in this particular case. So go back and watch my videos on forms of evidence. But I think there are two banner forms that are going to be really important in this case. Number one, behavior. Number two, forensic evidence. Now, the case likely involves complex forensic evidence that's related to the gunshot, ballistics, the circumstances of the shooting. And it's going to be incumbent upon the prosecution to present and interpret forensic evidence in a way that these experts and their expertise is effectively communicated to the jury. Think back to that little self-assessment we did earlier in this video when I had you envisioning holding that weapon. These are the kind of things that the prosecution's going to need to get the jury to do. And since we're talking about it, again, what are your thoughts, and are they any different now after you've heard a little more information on this case? And then we got to consider public perception and media attention. It is becoming more and more important in these cases, with arguments about how much already is out there and what influence what is out there might have on jurors, people testifying, and others. Now, high-profile cases often face the challenge of public perception and media attention. This one's no different. So managing the potential influence of public opinion in this trial, getting the jury and the witnesses to understand things in a fair legal process is going to be crucial in this case. And finally, the emotional impact of this case, especially given its tragic nature, could pose challenging in maintaining some level of objectivity, especially objectivity among the jurors. So balancing the emotional aspects with legal arguments and evidence presentation is going to be a common challenge that has to be overcome in this case. Now, this is going to be a perfect time for you to weigh in on your own emotions as you've been listening to this video. How would you vote if you were sitting on the jury today? As you vote, let's review the order on the defendant's motion to preclude the state from arguing intent to kill. And I think you're going to find this to be pretty interesting, because this is actually what caused the judge to rule in the way that he did. So we're going to go in, and you can see this on the screen. I'm going to point out a couple of parts that I've highlighted on here and read those as you look at them on the screen. The defendant shot and killed his wife on 25 September 2016. About this, there is no debate. And then the judge talks, the paper talks about the fact that this was argued back and forth during the trial. But then in the underlying portion, the state argued that the defendant shot her with the intent to kill, that he wanted his wife dead and out of the way for reasons both financial and amatory. And I had to look up amatory, because I didn't know that I understood the term. And here's what Webster says about it. Amatory is a definition of, or relating to, or inciting sexual love or desire. In other words, it is related to inducing, or it's related to and induced by sexual love or desire, or his desire that he's getting something out of this. I don't know. You figure that one out. And put your comments down below, because that one was interesting. And well, it went on to say that in that original trial, 12 jurors concluded that both sides were wrong, that this was no accident, that the defendant intentionally shot his wife, but only with the intent to seriously injure her. Now, what on earth is this all about? And I want to know what you're thinking about this, because this really troubles me. Number one, I don't know that you just shoot someone to seriously injure him. If you're going to pull the trigger, you're trying to stop them. And him shooting his wife in the back was not just to seriously injure her, in my opinion. But that's my opinion. Anyway, they say he committed an aggravated assault, not malice murder. Well, the defendant in his retrial is seeking to preclude the state from arguing that he intended to kill his wife, because they believe, and they frankly argued it successfully, that if they can keep that out, they can't charge him with murder. The state was resisting this claim, arguing variously that the intent to kill is an element of aggravated assault. Well, They went on to say that the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution agrees that there is no double jeopardy. No person shall be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. And they went on and said, in other words, if a jury necessarily decided a factual issue in rendering a verdict or an acquittal, that same issue may not be relitigated in a retrial of other counts for which there was not an acquittal. Went on to say, as has often been said, the first trial was all about the why. Why did the defendant have a loaded gun in his hand? Why was that loaded gun in his hand pointed at his wife? Why was the defendant's finger on the trigger of the loaded gun pointed at his wife's back? And most critically, why did the defendant pull that trigger? He had to exert 12.2 pounds of force in order to send that bullet into his wife's back. They go on to say, to prove malice murder, the state needs to show that malice murder, that the defendant caused the death of another person, which he did, that he did so unlawfully, and that he did so with malice aforethought. And that's the place where the state's having the problem this second time around, is proving that he actually intended to do that. And if they would have given the jury the first time around the option to take a lesser crime, they would not be here today. Well, malice, of course, is simply the unlawful intent to kill. The defendant must have intended to kill the victim for the jury to convict him for malice murder, which, if you remember, they did. They said any other crime resulting in death is something less than malice murder. Here, in this defendant's case, the only element of malice murder at issue was malice or intent. His wife was dead. He killed her. Nobody's arguing that. The question continues, did he intend to kill her? And the jury said that he did not. In fact, 12 jurors, all of them, 12 to zero, said he did not intend to kill. And that's a valid and final judgment, and that cannot now be relitigated, according to the court. And that's where the problem came, and that's why we're looking at aggravated assault. So they said, consequently, it's the order of this court that the state not argue at any retrial of the defendant on his remaining charges of aggravated assault, felony murder, possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony, that the defendant intended to kill his wife when he shot her. An evidentiary corollary to this directive is that any evidence of motive to kill his wife when he shot her is now excluded. It's tainted. It's out. So that means any evidence of the defendant's life insurance policy, her coverage, anything like that. And it goes in and puts a little footnote that says, as mentioned above, aggravated assault as charged in this indictment is aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and not aggravated assault with intent to kill. Thus, intent to kill is not a necessary element of any remaining charge, nor was it ever an element of any charge in this case other than malice murder, for which the defendant was acquitted. Remember, that jury said, we don't believe he tried to do this on purpose. So there you go, folks. It was so ordered, and that is the way that cookie crumbles. Now, overall, the Tex MacGyver case required the legal teams to navigate this complex web of evidence, witness testimonies, legal arguments, and to present a compelling case to the jury. In short, Claude Lee Tex MacGyver is going to continue to sit in jail as he waits for some legal maneuvering and a recommitted trial date. Now, keep in mind, here's some things you won't probably hear. MacGyver didn't call 911 after shooting his wife. Instead, he told the woman who was driving them home from their countryside estate to drive to Emory University Hospital, instead of stopping at a closer trauma center. He didn't call 911 to coordinate a meetup with paramedics. And according to a bunch of media reports, he didn't seem overall or overly distraught over the whole thing. But who's to say what is appropriate for Claude Lee, Tex MacGyver? Now, as this thing gets going, I want you to keep in mind that Judge McBurney probably made the right decision in blocking evidence that suggests that MacGyver wanted to kill his wife. Now, this might make you pretty angry, as it does me, but keep in mind that the state of Georgia is now charging MacGyver with aggravated assault, not intent to kill, suggesting that anything about suggesting this was an intent to kill would be highly prejudicial and, frankly, irrelevant to the many defense attorneys who are going to be working this thing. So we may not hear anything about Diane's change to her will, that change that occurred just before her death, or the life insurance policy that, again, will never be talked about. Holy cow. What a crazy ride down this rabbit hole we've had here. Now, the Tex MacGyver case is going to be a legal spectacle like none other, in my opinion. So if you enjoyed this deep dive into this courtroom drama, please don't forget to hit that like button. And make sure you're subscribing and sharing us with your friends. And if you'd like more intriguing content like this, let us know what trial or legal case you'd be interested in us covering next. So until then, stay curious, folks. Stay informed, and I'll catch you up on the next video. But first, look for Profiling Evil on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And please take advantage of Profiling Evil podcasts, especially during this holiday season as you're traveling over the river and through the woods to Grandma's house. You can find Profiling Evil podcasts on your favorite podcast platform. And hey, folks, don't forget the choir practice is returning to Profiling Evil beginning January 1st, New Year's Day. So really fast, it's coming up on us, and it's going to be every first Monday of every month in 2024. In January, I got FBI profiler Mark Safrick joining me on the first episode. So I hope you're going to be there and that you're going to join us. We're going to spend a whole lot more time talking together and answering questions. So thanks so much for your support of Profiling Evil. Hey, we'll see you all soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.